Thank you for tuning in. In today's conversation, we speak with Vijay Boyapati on how he got to investing in Bitcoin startups and his experience as an angel investor in the sector. It's a fascinating conversation. We hope you enjoy. Please remember to follow, like, or share. And as a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice.
Welcome to another episode of Build with Bitcoin. I'm your co-host, Israel Munoz. I'm joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow, and today we have the honor of having Vijay Boyapati on to the podcast. So we're very excited about today's episode. Vijay is an author, an educator in this space, as well as an angel investor. And although today's conversation, we want to maybe focus a little more on that angel investing and the why and how you go about that, Vijay, I think it would be very interesting to start with a little bit more about you and your background. Maybe if you can tell us a little bit about what got you into Bitcoin. But, you know, before that, reading and listening to some of your material, it seems like you have a great grasp of early stage technology, of Austrian economics. So, you know, maybe we can use that as a starting point. You know, what was your early career? And what got you into Bitcoin to start with?
Yeah, absolutely. So I came to the U.S. to do a PhD in computer science. I was going to do a PhD in machine learning. I didn't end up starting the PhD. I ended up at a company that was a startup at the time called Google. And so my career actually has had a lot of startups. I love working at startups. I feel like they are the most exciting places to be in terms of being a technologist, because you have so much control over the direction and success of the company, and you can have a really big impact, as opposed to, for instance, being an engineer at a company the size of Google today, where it's much harder to have a meaningful impact on the company as a whole. So I was at Google from 2002 to 2007. I left Google and went to do some political campaigning in the 2008 presidential election. I was trying to help Ron Paul get nominated as the Republican nominee for president. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. He was spreading a message that I think really resonates with Bitcoiners, the importance of sound money and peace and prosperity and avoiding foreign interventionism. I think these are all messages that resonate with Bitcoiners. Unfortunately, that didn't work out, and I felt pretty dejected by the political process and getting to see it up close and what it's actually like and what actually happens and the powers who actually have control over the political process. So I was pretty naive about all of that stuff. So then I went and did my own startup for a little while and was accepted into the incubator, a pretty famous incubator called Y Combinator in late 2011, and my co-founder and I, my co-founder actually was one of the people who got me into Bitcoin. And so just prior to us getting into Y Combinator, I discovered Bitcoin. I think it was like mid to late 2011. And I had a bet with one of my friends. This is another friend, there were two friends who got me into Bitcoin. Another friend, I had a bet about Federal Reserve policy, and I won the bet. And the bet was for a single silver coin. And my friend said, don't take the silver coin. Let me give you something else. Let me give you this thing called Bitcoin. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he explained that I needed to download some software from the internet and start running it. I started running the core software, and my laptop felt like it was going to melt. It got really hot. It was, you know, downloading the blockchain and verifying all the transactions. And then he showed me how to create an address, and then he sent me 5 bitcoins, which was the same value as the silver coin that he owed me. And I had no idea what was going on. He showed me that he had sent me the 5 on a block explorer, a very primitive block explorer at the time, so it was all just numbers and letters. And I said, okay, whatever. And I basically forgot about it, and I gave the laptop to one of my ex-girlfriends many years ago, when that laptop was lost and those bitcoins are now dead. Unfortunately, my first 5 bitcoins. But that really started my interest in Bitcoin. And because I had a background in Austrian economics, I was really fascinated with Bitcoin as a monetary phenomenon. And I'd been really interested in gold for, you know, at least 5 or 6 years before I came across Bitcoin. And the question of why does gold have any value? I think this is a, you know, critically important question, because I remember reading about Keynes talking about how gold was a barbaric relic, and Warren Buffett talking about how gold is essentially useless. It's pointless to move it from one hole to another hole on Earth. Like, it doesn't have any, you know, utility. And Warren Buffett is very much about investing in things that had utility. So I was really obsessed with this question of how can this useless rock, which can't really be used for anything else, have so much value, be worth trillions of dollars. And so I was already pretty primed to be interested in Bitcoin when I came across it in 2011. This is going a little bit off tangent, but I have a little funny story that I haven't shared before about being in Y Combinator. My co-founder and I, we built a search engine over all of the deal sites. I don't know if you guys remember at the time, Groupon and Living Social, and mm-hmm. there were hundreds of them at the time. And it was like the big fad at the time. And we thought, wow, you know, we are search people. We're from Google. Let's build a search engine. And we built a great product. It was really fantastic. But unfortunately, the space itself imploded. And Paul Graham, who is, you know, the renowned creator of Y Combinator, kept saying to us, you know, you guys can just, he said this actually just a few days before demo day. He said, you can just pivot out of this and change to some other startup, doesn't matter. And I didn't really understand that. I thought, you know, we've invested all this time in building this product. I want to pitch it to investors. Maybe there's something here. But he was right, because demo day is really about pitching an idea. It's not so much about a product. You're at such an early stage, and what you're trying to convince investors of is that you have a good idea and also that you're a good team. And so we definitely had time to pivot. And my co-founder really likes to remind me of an email he sent me right around that time where he was like, you know, we're both pretty interested in Bitcoin. Why don't we just build a startup that makes it easy for people to buy Bitcoin? And the way he described it was essentially explaining what Coinbase was. And Coinbase did join Y Combinator, I think, 2 cycles after us, maybe a year after us. Mm-hmm. And so my friend likes to remind me of this email and say, look, we could have been Coinbase. But it was really a very different time, because the regulatory environment was very different at that time. This was right around when Silk Road was sort of becoming prominent. And the reputation that Bitcoin had was as a currency for criminal activity. And so I was quite afraid that, you know, are we going to get in trouble building a website like this? I don't want to go to jail. And we had the opportunity at the time. We had $150,000 in seed investment from Y Combinator. And we could have put it all into Bitcoin. But that's actually exactly what my co-founder suggested we do. He said, well, why don't we just put all of our angel investment into Bitcoin, and then we'll make it a service to make it easy for people to buy Bitcoin. And it's painful. It's kind of painful to look back on that. You know, I think many people who have success in their life have these moments where they look back and think they could have had another huge success if they'd done the right thing. And I certainly have several of those in my career. And that's one I reflect back on and think, wow, we could have had a really successful and huge startup if we had really focused on Bitcoin at the time. But I was a little too afraid of the regulatory environment. I still hadn't fully wrapped my head around Bitcoin. It was only, you know, a few months after I discovered it. But that would have been a really a fun path in my life that was never taken.
And what did you end up pitching then, by the way, the original idea, the search engine for the group?
We pitched the deal site, the deal search engine that we were working on. Unfortunately, we got into Y Combinator. Groupon went public right around the same time we got into Y Combinator, and every single day Groupon's stock price went down. And so you can imagine at the end of the 3-month incubation of Y Combinator, investors in the space wanted to have nothing to do with it. And it was an incredibly difficult pitch. Most of them said, look, we're way overcommitted in this space. We don't want to invest anymore. A lot of them actually said, this space is dead. You need to get out as quickly as possible. And one thing I look back on is perhaps I was a little too stubborn. One thing that you're taught when you go into Y Combinator is to be persistent and, you know, fight through adversity. And there are startups like Airbnb, which had a lot of adversity early on and persisted and eventually became successful. So you can go either direction. This is one of the very difficult questions for startups is, when do you know that you should ditch your idea and pivot to something else? It's not obvious at all. And for me, you know, I stuck with what I thought we could turn into a business, and I was wrong. And if we had pivoted, we would have pivoted to something much, much bigger.
Well, can I add just a little context in there too? Which, that's a heartbreaking story, but I was introduced to Bitcoin in 2011, late 2011, by Shaq Khan. I don't know if you know Shaq, who was an investor, advisor to Spotify, and he started CoinDesk. And so I had a venture fund and a conference that supported the venture fund. It was about investing in early stage tech startups in LATAM. But I had at this conference, Shaq was talking about, he wanted to talk about Bitcoin. He's the one who introduced me to Bitcoin. And I couldn't figure out a way to buy it until early 2012, but in mid-2012 at the conference, and it was filled with VCs, Mike Maples, a lot of early stage VCs were there. And he asked the question, how many of you know about Bitcoin, and talked about it? And hardly anyone in the room. I mean, I was lucky to raise my hand at that time, but it was still, I think it would have been hard to get investors to invest in it. Also, whenever I mentioned it, I also heard the, isn't that for criminals, especially being based in Mexico? So it was, you know, it may not have gotten funded, but I think it would have, yeah, it would have been a great idea. But it's tough. Timing is also important with a startup.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I, you know, my experience with the audience of VCs who go to Y Combinator is that they would much rather invest in something crazy or something that's, you know, borderline gray market, that invest in something that looks like it's really dead. and the deal space, really by that stage, I think was quite obviously dead. And it became much clearer that it was a fad and that there wasn't any repeat business there. Businesses who used these deals were not enthusiastic about doing them again. There was massive attrition. All the signs sort of pointed to that space not being a viable space. Whereas, you know, in terms of moonshots, I think you could make the pitch, even though Bitcoin had this kind of taint of being associated with criminal activity, the market for money is just so gigantic that I think at that seed stage, I personally believe that we would have been able to get funding fairly easily for the seed stage. And then, you know, if we had done, as my friend suggested, put the $150,000 into Bitcoin at the time, we wouldn't have had to raise money ever again. So certainly, I look back on that, you know, with a little bit of regret, but mostly humor, because there's just so many opportunities like this in life that we miss and we don't act on. You need to think about the positive ones that you did act on and that improved your life.
The rate of growth of the Bitcoin price, no one, I think, can ever anticipate how much it went up and also how much it may go up from here, which is the premise of your book. And you're a lot of the work and the talking that you do on the bullish case for Bitcoin. So certainly that experience must have informed your perspective to see exactly what could have been and what you believe will happen. Can you talk a little bit about the framing that you have for the bullish case for Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it took me, I discovered Bitcoin late 2011, and I think it took me at least a couple of years before I'd wrapped my head around it. I became fascinated with it, and I think by 2014, I'd figured out why I thought it was valuable. And I refined my thinking on that over the years. When we got to the 2017 cycle, I started getting a lot of inbound requests from people who knew me and knew that I was interested in Bitcoin, asking me about, well, can you tell me more about Bitcoin? Why is this valuable? Is it a scam? And I think what most people at the time were lacking was an economic framework for thinking about why does this thing have any value at all? let alone why has the value been going up? So I set about writing an article to explain this, and really it was for friends and family, mostly for my mom, to say, why am I so crazy about Bitcoin? I never expected that it would get anywhere near as much interest as it did. It ended up getting read over a million times and translated by volunteers into 20 plus languages. And I eventually expanded it and turned it into a book, and it's been very successful. And it really sort of tackles the question of, more fundamentally, why does money have value? Because money is an asset that most people don't really understand. Most people can wrap their head around why stocks have value, or bonds, or real estate, because the idea of cash flow is pretty intuitive, right? You value stocks because they produce dividends, eventually they produce dividends, and you put a multiple on that. Or a property, you can figure out why it's valuable because it has rent, and you just put a multiple on that. Same thing for bonds as well. But money fundamentally doesn't have any cash flow. Through most of history, money, whenever it's been used by a human society, has been close to useless. And it's been something that doesn't produce anything. But it has this other function which is absolutely critical to human flourishing and the development of civilization. That's the ability to have a division of labor is not possible without money. And so societies have developed the use of money over time. And I really try and explain in my book why and what makes for a good money. And there are certain attributes that societies have sought out for money that have been known for a really long time. Aristotle wrote about them. Things like divisibility. You want your money to be easily divisible so it can function in trade, both large and small. You want it to be portable so you can take your wealth with you if you need to flee or if you want to do long distance trade. You want it to be fungible, so you want every unit to be equivalent to every other unit. So for instance, gold is superior to diamonds because they are irregular in shape and quality, so it makes it more difficult to trade value when you can't really tell whether what you're getting is a good diamond or a bad diamond. Probably the most important attribute that makes for a good money is scarcity. Because money is something that you don't only use in exchange, it's something that you want to keep your savings in, the fruits of your labor, through time and space. You want to be able to transport the fruits of your labor through time and space. And so scarcity gives you some confidence that the value of your savings aren't going to be melted away over time. So gold is a much superior form of money to sand. Because if you went to the beach and you took a bucket, you could become theoretically wealthy, but then everyone would do it. And so the money would lose its value very quickly. So that's really what I focused on in my book and article, is telling the story of money and then explaining that if you look at what makes for good money, Bitcoin is actually the best money that humans have ever seen. It has all of the attributes that make for an excellent money. And it really, in certain ways, it's far, far superior to gold. It's much easier to verify Bitcoin. You can transport it much more easily. So I liken Bitcoin to being gold with teleportation built in. It's like I can teleport gold to you, which is a really cool feature. Divisibility, it's certainly superior to gold. And security, it's much easier to secure Bitcoin. And one of the problems with gold is that if you have any kind of sizable wealth in gold, you don't want to hide it under your mattress. You don't want to have this physical asset that's worth a lot on your possession. So this sort of caused the centralization of custodianship and why gold was concentrated in these financial institutions by the beginning of the 20th century. And of course, Bitcoin is far superior to fiat monies along some of these attributes as well. In particular, it's superior to fiat money for the most important attribute, which is scarcity. Fiat monies can be created at will. And the decision to create them is basically political. So if you look at the attributes that make for good money, Bitcoin is by far the best money that humans have ever seen.
And so, Vijay, it sounds like for a good chunk of the last decade or so, you've decided to spend a lot of your time and work in Bitcoin. Your title of your famous article is, of course, very bullish stance on Bitcoin and the direction it's heading. So at what point do you also have a strong conviction on, okay, I know Bitcoin is, you know, maybe the best money we've seen to date. Why invest in Bitcoin companies then, beyond just Bitcoin, the asset?
As an investor, I think really the question boils down to, are my returns going to be better than if I invested in Bitcoin? And this is one thing I think is very interesting about being an investor in the Bitcoin space, is most Bitcoiners measure the success of their investment against Bitcoin, not against dollars. And it's a much, much higher bar to outperform Bitcoin. And actually, perhaps controversially, I wrote about this on Twitter several years ago. I said, it doesn't make sense to invest in Bitcoin companies because there are almost no companies in this space that have outperformed Bitcoin, because Bitcoin has, you know, from when I got interested in it, it's 10,000x'd in value. It's gone up so much that it would have been very, very difficult. Perhaps if you'd been at the earliest stage angel investment in Coinbase, you would have kept pace with Bitcoin. But then if you adjusted for liquidity, Bitcoin would have still been better, because like Coinbase, you didn't have liquidity for most of that time, and Bitcoin you did. You could have sold in and out, and you could have done various things that you couldn't have done with these pre-IPO shares of Coinbase. There's this idea in investing that it's a good idea to invest in picks and shovels businesses. For instance, like if there's a gold rush, you want to be the person who invests in selling picks and shovels and not actually digging for gold. I sort of take the opposite point of view, that if gold were being monetized, if gold was still in the process of being monetized and was a sort of early stage money, you wouldn't want to invest in picks and shovels. You would want to be digging in the ground and trying to get as much gold as possible. And I think that has been true for most of Bitcoin's history. I do think, however, we are at an inflection point where it now is starting to make sense to be an investor in companies in the Bitcoin space, because I think it's essentially impossible for Bitcoin to do another 10,000x from here. Certainly 100x is possible from here, and I still think Bitcoin is the best asymmetric investment for its risk profile. But you, I don't think you can still get the kind of angel returns that you get if you're an early stage investor. So I think that moment to pivot to picks and shovels in the Bitcoin space is going to come. And I think it's going to come probably in this cycle, perhaps at worst the next cycle for Bitcoin. And so I do see that there's going to be a lot of opportunity. We're so early in this space. There are going to be companies that we haven't heard of yet, which are going to be massive in the future. But you mentioned, like, why did you... This all sounds like I should not have invested in any company, by the way. But I have. I have invested in a handful of companies. Part of it is just seeing things you want in the space, right? Even if you think that it might not be as good a return as Bitcoin, there may be something that you want in the space that you think is important. Or alternatively, you could see potential in a team. You could meet a founder and just think they're amazing as a person, and their history or their tenaciousness or their scrappiness is something that you want to invest in. So there could be other reasons besides this more general reason that I've been giving for why you shouldn't invest in the space. And I've certainly come across those reasons a handful of times, and happy to talk about those.
Yeah. When you're looking at, I mean, you have that unique perspective of having an engineering background, early startup background. So when you're, you probably have the ability to look ahead and being familiar with Bitcoin. What are the picks and shovels that you feel that we need today to help the system? Like, maybe not limited to what you've already invested in, but would improvements in mining or wallets or adoption techniques? I mean, what are some of the things that custody solutions? What are some of the things that we really need in order to advance Bitcoin adoption?
Yeah, I think all of those things, Lynn, are incredibly important. Certainly, you know, wallet technologies today is still quite primitive. I think it could be a lot easier for the average person to be able to self-custody. Certainly, we need a lot more improvement there. And that was one of my investments was in a hardware wallet. You know, one of the perspectives I have had and have written about this on Twitter is that there are a lot of mistakes being made by companies in the space currently by pursuing a horizontal business strategy. And what I mean by that is that they're sort of pursuing revenue from as many altcoins as possible. The fee generation that comes from people trading back and forth between all these altcoins and building these businesses, which no different really, in my opinion, to casinos. I think the big business opportunity going forward is pursuing a vertical business strategy, which is pursuing the financialization of Bitcoin itself. And that means the whole financial stack from custody to brokerage to derivatives to lending and to building more sort of esoteric financial products on top of Bitcoin. For instance, you can build derivatives on top of Bitcoin as collateral that would allow people to get price exposure to US stocks, even if they're not in the US. It's possible to create derivatives. For instance, if you're someone in Bangladesh and you want to purchase Apple stock, but you don't have a direct mechanism, it should be possible to create a business where you post collateral and there is some derivative that tracks Apple's price. And so you get Apple price exposure as someone who lives in a country that doesn't have necessarily access to the US stock market. So I think there's a huge opportunity still in building out that vertical financial stack on top of Bitcoin as the sort of monetary base. You also mentioned, I think there's still huge opportunities in education. In terms of global adoption, we're only at a few percent. We're going to need to really improve education to get the rest of the world onto Bitcoin. Just improving the on-ramps in general. The on-ramps to me still feel like they're pretty difficult. Although I think that with the approval of the ETFs, we're going to have that, you know, late majority of people probably get price exposure to Bitcoin through those rather than through the native Bitcoin financial stack.
And Vijay, when you're looking at these companies for potential investment, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but what would you say are the main criteria you personally are searching for? Was it idea and the team behind it was the two that I heard you mention?
Yeah, I think it is really the team is the most important thing at the early stage, because so few ideas when you're investing as an angel pan out. And what you'll find if you're an early stage startup is you often have to pivot and pivot several times, because what you're doing as an early stage company is you're looking for product market fit. And it's only in the later round series A and more like series B where you fully established product market fit that you start getting venture capital money. So seed stage is really about, is this team of entrepreneurs or engineers, do they have the talent to be able to find product market fit? And do they have the scrappiness? Do they have the engineering talent? Are they so passionate about this space that they're in that they're willing to work like endless hours? Because when you're at a startup, there's so much to do, and it's, you really are. Like when I was in Y Combinator, it was like we would wake up in the morning, we're sleeping on air mattresses in an apartment in Mountain View. We'd wake up in the morning, we'd go to our desk, we'd code all day, and we'd go to bed like, you know, past midnight. And so we were working 12-hour days like every day for many, many months. Unfortunately, in the wrong space, but you have to have that passion, you have to have that scrappiness to be willing to figure stuff out. And one of the warning signs I think about investing in companies, you have someone who comes from a big established company and they have that mindset of working in a big company. Being successful in an early stage startup is very different to being successful at a big company like Google today, because you're a jack of all trades. You have to figure out so many different things. You have to figure out like setting up your SQL database, but also do marketing and figure out the legal stuff. And you got to do everything. And if you don't do it, the company's dead. So I definitely put a premium on scrappiness. Passion is another one. I think the idea is probably the last in line, because who knows? Ideas themselves aren't worth that much. It's execution that matters. And the people who are successful as startup founders are the ones who can execute. Of course, they have to have a reasonable idea, but they also have to, you know, work and have good business judgment and make it work in the end.
Hey, as an angel investor in the companies you're in, I mean, you bring so much to the table with all of your, you know, experience that can help a startup. How active are you in the day-to-day, or how involved do you get, or it varies from project to project?
Honestly, it may sound strange. I haven't been super active in working with the companies. I've sort of followed along. It's just my personal life has been so busy in the last few years with the work that I do. I'm also still doing some political work. I still do a lot of writing, and we have 4 kids at home. So I like to keep my sort of fingers in that startup world because I just feel like it's so exciting. And I did get one piece of advice from Justin Kahn, who used to be a partner at Y Combinator, that I thought was a really cool piece of advice, which is, no matter what, always invest in your friends. Because if they do a startup and it becomes successful and you didn't invest, you will never hear the end of it. So make sure to put a little seed stage investment when you know, friends or family come along and say that they're doing a business. Because it's fun to be involved and have some skin in the game and to root for people you care about.
Well, there's a great unexpected piece of advice for any interested entrepreneurs. Vijay, you mentioned a wallet in the space. Can you speak to what other sectors within the Bitcoin space you've invested in so far? What type of startups you've been getting excited about?
Yeah, so I've invested in a few now. There's the wallet startup that was working on a Bitcoin multi-sig wallet, a hardware wallet. There is, this sounds really boring, but I think it's really important, a company that helps people who invest in Bitcoin prepare their taxes, because they were created in 2017, and there were a lot of confusing issues for people who were owners of Bitcoin, especially, I don't know if you guys remember the forks, the Bitcoin forks, like Bitcoin Cash, that were created. Mm. What was the tax treatment there? The IRS wasn't issuing guidance. Tracking your coins, the basis of your coins, and whether you should do first in, first out, or last in, first out. There are a lot of issues around, you know, doing taxes on your crypto assets if you're in Bitcoin and other assets. So I thought that was kind of good picks and shovels business. And the person who started that was incredibly scrappy, very motivated, you know, super type A personality. And I thought, yeah, there's potential here for something bigger. And they're doing quite well as well. I don't know whether it's going to turn into like a huge kind of unicorn type business, but there's certainly a need for that. I invested in a company called Galoy, which provides services for people in South America for just financial services, sort of for the village level, for people to own Bitcoin and to transact Bitcoin with each other. And that's a really interesting business, because I'm not even sure, like, you know, what the business is there, like whether it could be a huge business, but I feel like it's something that really could benefit communities in South America. And so I was interested in it more for that perspective. And lastly, there's an energy startup called Giga Energy that's been doing fantastically well. I think it's probably the most successful of my investments, at least this stage, looking at their revenue growth, which is basically very hockey stick-like. And they go out and they find abandoned energy sources or energy sources that would otherwise be wasted and make use of it for Bitcoin mining. And it's also really great for the environment too, because they find, you know, places where they're drilling for oil. One of the byproducts of drilling for oil is methane, which gets outgassed. They sort of flare it off and burn it off. But the burning off of methane is really quite inefficient. A lot of it goes up into the atmosphere, and methane is, you know, many, many times more destructive to the atmosphere than carbon. So what they do is they go and they capture that methane and they use it as an energy source to mine Bitcoin. Because all you really need as a Bitcoin miner is an energy source and an internet connection. So in these places where you have energy that's otherwise just being thrown away are perfect for Bitcoin miners. And the benefit here is twofold. It's you get Bitcoins produced from this otherwise abandoned energy, and you're sequestering the energy in a way that's far more efficient than burning it off. So, instead of having like 30 or 40% efficiency in burning it off, you get like 90 plus efficiency in extracting it and using it for mining Bitcoin. So I'm very excited about that startup. And that was an example of a startup founder, Matt Lostra, who is just one of the scrappiest people I've ever met. He's the kind of guy who'll make anything work. I didn't, like, when I invested, I had no idea whether the business would be successful, but every time he sends a report, I'm like, holy smokes, this is like growing like a weed. And it's really cool, right? It's cool to be an investor in a company like that and see that success and be able to cheer him on from the sidelines. And I don't know if I have much expertise that can help him in the business he's in, but I'm always there. I'm always, if he ever sort of taps me and says, could you get some more exposure to what we're doing, or could you help in a particular way, I'd always be willing to help. But I'm excited about all of them. I think it's cool to get a sort of a view of the space, have a sort of a broad perspective of what's happening in the space. And I feel lucky as an angel investor that I do get deal flow. That's the big thing, right? As an angel investor, the thing you want more than anything else is deal flow, because you want to have the opportunity to invest in these startups. And I speak to a lot of people when I go to conferences, and so I feel lucky to be able to invest in companies. So if you are in the Bitcoin space and think you're doing a startup, please, send me a DM. I'd love to hear from you.
I have a couple of companies I know of that are going to pass that information along to you in the LATAM region, because, part of it are geographical opportunities too. I mean, Bitcoin's global. And so depending on the geographical region, you might have unique, like Galloway, they're meeting a demand within their local market, and it could replicate throughout different regions of the world. But it may not fit in Silicon Valley or, in traditional pockets where investors are. But Vijay, you're privileged because you've been inside of the system for so long, inside of tech and Bitcoin. So the deal flow could come to you. But if someone is interested in angel investing, how would you advise them to become a little bit more aware of deals or opportunities or what spaces they should look in or how to get to know founders? Any advice you could offer an angel investor or someone interested in that space?
Yeah, I think you pointed something out, which is great about Bitcoin, but also it makes it more difficult, is that, it's really a global space. And the difficulty as an angel investor is that, there could be deals happening in other countries that you have no idea about. If you're starting without many connections, I think you really need to make those personal connections. You need to get to conferences, you need to meet people and become known, and seek out entrepreneurs in your local city. If you have a city where there's a sort of an entrepreneurial spirit, there are some hubs. I think if you were really serious about being an angel investor and putting a lot of time and capital into it, I would want to move to one of those hubs. I'd want to move to Austin or perhaps Silicon Valley or perhaps Frog. Find one of those hubs and plant yourself there where there is a strong Bitcoin community, and find those entrepreneurs in the local economy who are passionate about Bitcoin and are just looking for an idea or looking for some capital, and encourage them and say, look, I would be interested in investing in your startup. Here's some seed capital, and here's what you need to do to get started. There's a lot of work you need to do to get the deal flow. Like, very few people or companies are like Y Combinator, where the deal flow comes to them. If you want, you can also try and become an influencer in some sense. And if you become prominent enough within the Bitcoin community, through whatever means you choose, then you will probably get some deal flow naturally by people seeking you out and saying, hey, I have a startup, would you consider investing in it?
Oh, well, there's some great pieces of advice there, both for startups and interested investors, Vijay. So, I think it's all super useful. One thing that I'd love to get your perspective on, Vijay, is how mature are we with this technology as far as, maybe some people still view this as some sort of experiment, let's say. Is there anything that still kind of worries you or that you would highlight as a risk as far as the Bitcoin network itself? Or what makes you so so convicted in the technology and the opportunities that you're just dedicating most of your time into this?
I think Bitcoin has been massively de-risked from, when Lynn and I first got exposed to Bitcoin. I mean, it's basically been brought in within the regulatory system. The fact that the SEC, although reluctantly, approved the ETFs has really fully brought it within the regulatory framework of the US financial system. So I think that, to me, that was the biggest outstanding risk for Bitcoin, was ultimately a nation state attack against Bitcoin. And I thought that that question would be resolved in the next, 5 or so years. And I think the answer is probably here. I think that that is very, very unlikely now. We have very powerful financial interests who have benefited pretty tremendously. Like BlackRock, for instance, has launched the fastest growing ETF in the history of, the US market. It got to, I think, close to $20 billion under management in just a couple of months. So that's unprecedented. And certainly the other financial players in the space, like the Goldman Sachs and the Fidelities, are paying attention to this, and they want to be involved as well. So I think the regulatory risk is dramatically lower now than it was even 3 months ago. So I give a number of risks in my book related to Bitcoin. So, for instance, protocol risk was a big risk in the early days. Was Bitcoin actually a protocol that worked? We didn't really know, right? In 2010, 2011, it was still an open question. Could someone break Bitcoin? Then I thought that there was a risk on, what is the internal vision for what Bitcoin is within the Bitcoin community? And we had the block size wars. And that was the last point I felt like that I had any uncertainty about Bitcoin. It was a moment when the most powerful companies and owners of Bitcoin and miners tried to come together to change Bitcoin to benefit themselves, as opposed to being, Bitcoin being something that benefits the world in general. And they failed. And to me, that was a test to show Bitcoin's resilience. And from that moment on, I really believed that Bitcoin was inevitable, in the sense that it's basically impossible to kill Bitcoin now. Whether Bitcoin becomes the world's global reserve currency or not, that is an open question. But I really think it's very difficult to kill Bitcoin. The big risk, I think, in terms of Bitcoin becoming the world's reserve currency was a nation state attack. And now I think that risk is mostly diminished as well. So I think I look at it right now and I see Bitcoin as the best asymmetric bet that it's ever been. Despite the fact that it's 10,000x'd, the risk has dropped so dramatically that while the upside might not be as great as it was in 2011, the risk level is many orders of magnitude lower than it was. So back in 2011-12, I remember Wences Casares telling people, hey, just get 1% of your portfolio in Bitcoin. And that's when the risk level was much, much higher. I think, if you're considering Bitcoin as a part of your portfolio now, it makes sense to have a much higher percentage because there is nowhere else that you have the potential for 100x with the risk profile of Bitcoin.
Maybe that also leads to another commonly asked question. How do you, specifically with regards to building a company? And you kind of mentioned actually the fact that if you had pivoted when you were at Y Combinator and taken the 150,000, you would have never had to raise capital again, right? So with everything you just touched on, Vijay, what are your thoughts around Bitcoin as a treasury management tool in the light of an early stage growth company?
Yeah, I think there's a huge benefit to doing that. And I look back at the example of BitPay. They took their, I think it was their Series A, or maybe it was their seed round, I can't remember, but it was one of their early rounds and they put all of it into Bitcoin. And they really didn't need to raise another round after that. So I think there's a lot of benefit to doing that. I think also what we talked about before in terms of investors wanting to outperform Bitcoin, If you're keeping all of your profits in dollars, it becomes difficult to outperform Bitcoin unless you have enormous growth. I think of the, you know, on the one hand, you have BitPay, which didn't have to raise that much money, but wasn't that successful of a company. And I think of Coinbase almost as like a tragedy compared to that, where they had enormous Bitcoin cash flow, natural cash flow from the fees from people trading. They could have put aside a big chunk of that in Bitcoin and still had enough internal cash flow to pay for employees and been much, much bigger company than they are today. They could have been Michael Saylor times 10. And it's a really a huge lost opportunity. In terms of startups, you do need to worry about cash flow and runway. And Bitcoin's volatility makes that problem a little more complex, right? Because you don't want to take a seed round in Bitcoin at the peak of the market and have like 18 months runway and then Bitcoin crashes and now you've got like 4 months of runway. So at the early stage, I think there is something to be said about having enough runway that you can comfortably get to your next round of funding. But once you achieve escape velocity, and some companies achieve that earlier than others, putting aside some fraction of what would be your profit into Bitcoin, I think makes a lot of sense. And that can also work in your favor. If you have enough runway to make it to the next round, if you have enough money that you can set aside into Bitcoin, then that could help you basically avoid doing the next round and keeping a lot more of the equity and not giving it to investors.
But then exits too. I mean, I think the whole Bitcoin mentality, you know, may change the vision for what a trajectory is for a startup. So I think today it's like the idea is you get VC funding, VCs need an exit. And so what is that exit? It's going public or in more recent times, tokenization of companies so that they exit early and then leave the growth stage to less invested investors, you know, in the company or less knowledgeable. So I feel that the tokenization has really been a detriment to startup growth. And, you know, I think it really leaves startups with not long-term vision in how they think about their company. How do you think about that in terms of Bitcoin playing out and just the whole way a company sees its future growth?
Yeah, I do like the idea. I haven't given it too much thought, but I do like the idea of a company being able to build cash flow and savings in Bitcoin and then look for a different kind of exit, which is perhaps not going public, but just distributing dividends as Bitcoin. I mean, the one thing I think is really cool about MicroStrategy is that what are they trying to optimize? They're not trying to optimize dollar profit or the dollar value of their shares necessarily. They're trying to maximize the number of Bitcoins held per share. So they have a real Bitcoin mindset. They are living on a Bitcoin standard. Michael Saylor is basically saying, can I accrete more Bitcoins per share using, you know, the financial engineering techniques that he's using. And he's been quite successful at that, despite the fact that they've diluted their shares by selling more shares and issued a lot of convertible debt, which can be converted into equity. The number of Bitcoins held by MicroStrategy per unit share has risen pretty significantly. And I think if you're in the Bitcoin space, that's the mindset you should have. How do I accumulate more Bitcoins per share? Because my investors are probably thinking that too. Should I have just invested in Bitcoin? If you have a startup founder who has that mindset, that would give investors a lot of confidence that they're trying to accumulate more Bitcoins for their investors than those investors could have gotten just by buying on the market.
Yeah. I love this thought exercise of thinking about, you know, how, I mean, it's another example of how Bitcoin changes everything or fixes everything. And I think that, you know, in some cases, this fiat mentality of growth at all costs, no matter what, has been hurtful for building really successful companies that I think will last, you know, just add value, real value. And I think we've seen this a lot in the tech companies where sometimes the growth has been at the cost of privacy or security or personal information. And so you know, to have companies that have a foundation where you're really thinking long term and for the benefit of your partners, which are your investors and your users, that, you know, hopefully it'll kind of evolve this next phase of tech growth on the Bitcoin stack into better technology for everybody.
Yeah, I like the idea of the flexibility that comes from having a treasury in Bitcoin and eventually being able to have a lot of flexibility in your business because you've accumulated a large enough treasury that you have the freedom to decide what's the best for the business long term. In a way, it's kind of similar to these companies and startups where the founders grant themselves these super voting shares. And it allows them to keep control. And you can see that some of these startups have been more successful because they've had that sort of vision from the founder that hasn't been diluted by later shareholders coming in with really short-term mindsets. And I'm thinking about, for instance, Google and Facebook, where the early founders kept these super voting shares and so had very strong control on the direction of the company, and they have very long-term visions, and they're not subject to the pressure of the short-termism of the market that can often be, you know, seen in other companies.
And even the one public company we've talked to, one of the public companies we talked about, MicroStrategy, I mean, Michael Saylor has effectively maintained the control of that company, so he's been able to exercise his unique and long-term vision relative to the Bitcoin position, which has just been a brilliant move, and I think will really be, you know, a case study in the future. And I'm surprised more people aren't following that playbook. But
yeah, it blows my mind that more CEOs have not, especially CEOs with stable but boring businesses with stable and boring cash flow. I mean, that's what MicroStrategy was. It was a pretty boring business whose stock that, you know, did nothing for 20 years, and then Saylor figured out there's this equity premium and that stocks have a premium really over what should be justified by their cash flow. And he used that as a way of getting more Bitcoin by selling equity. And every time the shares went up enough, he saw the premium was high enough to dilute the share base to get more Bitcoins to get the hardest asset on earth. And then he did something even more amazing, which was realize that there's this huge pent-up demand in the bond market for Bitcoin, and there's no natural way to get exposure in the bond market to Bitcoin, so why not produce convertible debt? You know, then the bond market gets Bitcoin exposure by getting MicroStrategy equity. And what is MicroStrategy equity? It's equity as a holding company of Bitcoin. He figured out the bond market has this demand, and he provided the supply and got debt at very, very favorable terms. I agree with you, Lynn. It's kind of amazing that he figured this out and that no one else has sort of looked over at MicroStrategy and said, why don't we try that?
And then I also look at, this is a mature tech company, but the last two MicroStrategy worlds, he's come out with some really innovative products. Like last year, talking about converting email addresses into Lightning addresses to enable anybody to receive Lightning micropayments for showing up for a meeting. If Amazon were to do this to get Lightning payments, micropayments for submitting a review or for, you know, contributing, I think that's an idea that will absolutely happen. It may be a little ahead of the time. And then this last couple of months ago, the identity verification. So here's a company that's taking the practical use of Bitcoin once you get into the ecosystem and you see what the potential is for, you know, SAP payments and flowing value to someone over the internet. And he's got the SaaS company background to do it, to innovate inside of an older tech company. So I don't know.
Isn't it incredible? We talk about the idea of pivoting, and it's typically, you know, related to startups because you're trying to find a product market fit. But here we have this company that's 20 plus years old that's pivoting to becoming a Bitcoin company.
And I think it also speaks to the size of the potential market. And as an investor, just generally, that's one of the things that an investor has to do, right? Is size up what's the potential market for this. So, I mean, getting back to something you mentioned earlier, Vijay, is one of the reasons that you stay active and are an educator in the space because you still see this tremendous opportunity ahead. And I mean, you mentioned earlier in the episode, the potential market for Bitcoin is money. So maybe for some listeners that haven't gone through the thought process, how big of a market are we talking about here?
I think you have to think about what is the size of the store of value market, the assets that people use to keep their savings. And that's truly enormous. That's like the global bond market, which I think Bitcoin is really ripe to disrupt. There's real estate, for instance. I live in Seattle, and the city just north of me is Vancouver, BC in Canada. There are a lot of houses that are empty because you have Chinese investors who have bought houses and just keep them as a store of value because they're worried about their savings being confiscated in China, so they have this escape valve. I mean, a house in Vancouver is nowhere near as good a store of value as Bitcoin. It's less liquid, it's not portable, it doesn't have as much upside, it's a pain in the butt to maintain, local regulations might boot you out. I mean, it's a terrible, that's just a small example of the potential of the disruption. Bitcoin is slowly but surely going to disrupt all of these art market, for instance. Although I should say, wherever there is a monetary premium, I think Bitcoin will eventually disrupt that. That is an asset which has this kind of, people holding it as a store of value, it gets this monetary premium. Art is something that has not just a monetary premium, it has a status premium. And I think status premiums are never going to go away because It's just human nature for us to want to sort of show our status to other humans. And that owning, rare artwork is one of those different ways. But I think in terms of store of value, you have gold, you have real estate, you have the bond market. Even stocks have a sort of liquidity premium. There's people using them as a store of value, just putting money into them regardless of their cash flow. And people do that through, things like their 401k. They get some salary and they don't even think about it. They just toss it into stocks. I think eventually that monetary premium is going to be whittled away by Bitcoin. In the short term, though, I think you can just look at gold as Bitcoin's closest cousin and realize that Bitcoin is far superior to gold along all the attributes that make gold valuable. So even in the short term, in my mind, in the next 5 to 10 years, Bitcoin has a pretty easy 10x just to catch up to gold. And then on top of that, you can begin disrupting these other much bigger markets than gold.
Well, I mean, fascinating background and conversation, Vijay. I mean, we truly do appreciate it. I know we're kind of closing up on time here. Lynn, any other thoughts or questions?
Just want to shout out Vijay's book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, if you haven't read it. Vijay, you want to point people, we'll put it included in the show notes, but any closing thoughts that you have and why entrepreneurs should be bullish about building with Bitcoin and why investors should be bullish about investing in companies that are building with Bitcoin?
Yeah, just to summarize stuff we've talked about, I think Bitcoin is the most de-risked that it's ever been. The risk level of Bitcoin is so much lower now than it's ever been, but the upside is still there. So I think it's still a fantastic time to get interest in Bitcoin, to learn about it, to invest in it. And I do think we are at the point where there is going to be that transition to it being worthwhile to invest in picks and shovels businesses in Bitcoin. So if you are an entrepreneur, I think it is a good time to think about what services could you build. People always get caught up on like this idea. I've heard it so many times. Am I too late? There are all these businesses already. There's Coinbase and tons of wallet companies. But I like to remind people of very early on in my career before I joined Google, there were a lot of search engines. It was AltaVista and Excite and Dogpile, and I don't even, there's so many of them. And the people thought that market was saturated and dead. And then along came Google with a neat, elegant idea that you could do search well and do it simply, and blew up into one of the biggest companies on earth. The companies that will be big in the Bitcoin space, a lot of them don't even exist yet. So if you're an entrepreneur, get involved now. It's a fantastic time because the upside to angel investments now, I think, can keep pace with Bitcoin or even exceed Bitcoin. I don't think that was true, say, 5 or 10 years ago, but it's probably true now and definitely will be true over the next few years.
Well, we can't thank you enough, Vijay. It's been a fascinating conversation, and you know, hopefully we get a chance to have you back on at a future time.
I would love that. Thanks for chatting with me, guys.
Thanks so much, Vijay. I think it's been really inspirational for entrepreneurs, for investors, and for ourselves. We really appreciate your time and willingness to talk with us.
Thanks.